ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening on the ESPN app, Apple Podcast, wherever you get your fine podcasts. Rate us, review us. We like 5 stars. Give us 4 stars. All I think is that you are being a hater. Coming up on this episode, we got LeBron James doing it all and me going to an esports competition. But first, Dallas Cowboys, America's team. Now, I have mentioned this Dallas Cowboys, America's team thing before in the context of this national anthem discussion because they are branded as America's team. This does make it a little bit different for Jerry Jones than he makes it with anybody else. Like, legitimately national franchises in the National Football League, like with a true national fan base. I would say that the Packers have a national fan base. I would say the Steelers have a national fan base. They've been dormant for a long time because of their lack of success, but the Raiders have a national fan base and the Cowboys, right? I may have missed one in this list, but that's really the four. Everybody else is really a regional phenomenon. Those are the four that are national, right? And so when Jerry starts talking about what to do with the national anthem, I get that he's got a whole lot of people to please. And he has decided that the people that he's going to try to please are the people who, well, a lot of them are making America great again. Like that is the people whose opinions that he is concerned about. Look, his opinion on what should be done during the national anthem is right in line with President Trump's. Exactly, right? Like the idea of the Cowboys saying that they're going to release players if they do not stand with a toe on the line during the national anthem. That is exactly what the president has said. So it is fair, absolutely, to say that Jerry Jones is doing this to appeal to people who want to make America great again. You can't say I'm reaching on it. It's right there. Now, what this means as a result is by Jerry doing this, he puts his players in a very interesting position where they then have to answer for what is said. Now, one thing about the Cowboys, and I think a lot of people think about the Cowboys in the context of the 1990s. I also think people think of the Cowboys in the context of the chances that Jerry is willing to take on players who may have some things that have gone on in their past for various reasons. But I think a part of it that people don't think about is getting those guys when they're vulnerable is a great way to create someone who will do what you tell them to do. Right. If you present yourself as the person that's saving them, right? You present yourself as the person that in the face of all these things, you're the one that stood by them, then you're in line to get some loyalty from that person. I'm not saying that Jerry is necessarily that cynical about these things, but I also don't have any reason to believe that Jerry Jones just really cares that much about helping his fellow man. You know what I'm saying? Like I think that all of us could agree on that one right there. But Jerry has a team of guys who don't really get out of line. You know? Like I say, it might fail some drug tests or something like that, but they're not really getting out of line. And by the way, when they do get out of line, Greg Hardy got put off of the Cowboys partially because he wasn't so great as a pass rusher, but it was like showing up late to meetings and stuff like that. He wasn't in line. They've built a team of guys that they believe that they can get to stay in line, right? That's what Jerry has built up there. And so now he has gone in front of them and said, all right, if you guys do anything to protest during the national anthem, you will be cut. Do you realize the leverage that a whole lot of those players would have in week two of the season if they did kneel? Because for a lot of guys, your contract is guaranteed after week one. Like you make it through week one, your contract winds up guaranteed. You kneel during week two, you get your money from Jerry, then you can go play somewhere else if you down to test them. And apparently Jerry Jones doesn't believe he got anybody on his squad who was down to test him. And I've long thought that, like, they ain't gonna be so far that you're gonna go out here poking dudes in the chest. Just as a general thing, like, making it clear to people that you have them in line. Like, if you're gonna have your people in line, you kinda just need to have them in line. No matter who they are, no matter what the circumstance is, even with dealing with your children, they ain't been so long that they willing to tolerate somebody telling them who's in charge. They ain't been so long they willing to tolerate getting poked in the chest like that. And Jerry and his son Steven have poked his team in the chest by saying, if you do that, you will be cut. So why would I be surprised that this is Dak Prescott's response when asked about the national anthem and how to behave during it?
No, I never protest. I never protest during the anthem, and I don't think that's the time or the venue to do so. The game of football has always brought me such a peace, and I think it does the same for a lot of people. A lot of people playing the game, a lot of people watching the game, a lot of people have any impact of the game. So when you bring such a controversy to the stadium, to the field, to the game, it takes away. It takes away from that. It takes away from the joy and to the love that football brings a lot of people. And so for me, I'm all about making a change, making a difference. And I think this whole kneeling and all that was all about just raising awareness, and the fact that we're still talking about social injustice years later, I think we got to that point. I think we've proved and we know that there's social injustice. So I'm up for taking a next step, that whatever that step may be, for action and not just kneeling. I've always believed standing up for what I believe in, and that's what I'm going to continue to do.
Yeah, I think it's fair to ask the question as to whether or not Dak needed to go the extra mile in the way that he did, but that dude ain't got no leverage. That dude hasn't made any money. How do you think it goes for Dak Prescott? If Dak Prescott, like, for example, is the guy who kneels, like, how does that work out for him? I don't know if he built for everything that comes with that. I don't know if I'd be built for everything that came with that. So no, he's not going to be the guy who is going to do that. Now, his opinion is his opinion. He's allowed to feel however he feels about this. If he feels that the football field is some sanctuary that gives him peace while people are getting maimed, you know, whatever. All right. That's his thing. If he just believes that the football field is a place that all we should talk about is joy and all of these things, if that's what he feels, okay, cool. That's how he feels. He gets to believe that as such. It's just an interesting look when you seem to be parroting what your boss said. But again, on a certain level, I could understand why he feels as though that is what he has to do. I could totally see it if that was the play that he decided to make. We got this one here from Ezekiel Elliott. Listen to him.
Us as a team, we chose to stand together for the national anthem. And it was our decision, and I think it just shows our culture. It shows that, you know, that we have unity. We're going to stand as one. That's not knocking anyone else who may choose to kneel during the national anthem, but we're the Dallas Football Cowboys, America's team. We stand for the national anthem.
All right, now, I mean, what do you think that guy is going to say? Right? The thing that made it awkward to hear Zeke Elliott say that is the same reason why he says it. What makes it awkward to hear him saying this? We are America's team, and you start going dead on a line about what America's team is and the people that you represent and how you need to comport yourself as a member of America's team. The NFL suspended Ezekiel Elliott for a significant period of time behind an allegation of domestic abuse. Now, I understand that for some people, there is some ambiguity as to whether or not the events went as portrayed by the league, right? I understand where those people are coming from. However, I think we could put it this way. There's reason to believe that he put his hands on a woman, right? It may be incorrect, but it is fair to say there's reason to believe that, and that there are a lot of people who believe that. I don't know if you necessarily get to be the dude to extol your character because of your willingness to put the toe on the line during the national anthem. However, if you were accused of domestic abuse, which, by the way, he denied, right? But if you are accused of this and your team owner has your back all the way through the process, defends you to a point where he gave damage to the relationship that he had with the commissioner of the NFL, well, what you think he's going to say? Jerry says that we're going to stand on the line for the national anthem. That's what he says. That would be the same Jerry that had my back when I was accused of domestic abuse. Jerry say he's going to stand on the line, and that means that he's going to wind up standing on the line. Like, I get the fact that these dudes don't have leverage in this. I also entertain the possibility that their views are what they said. Like, maybe they feel exactly in the way that they felt when they said that. I have no idea. But I do ask, no matter what side you are on this issue, understand what the circumstances are that surround these dudes, right? Understand the place that they're in. I think that there are a lot of people who support those who kneel during the national anthem who look at Dak Prescott and look at Ezekiel Elliott and they chastise them for the statements that they made in that moment. And I could certainly understand why those people would chastise the sentiment that they offered. I also don't really know what else those dudes were supposed to do. Like those dudes in that situation. Those dudes ain't like 31, 32 years old, right? They're not at that point yet in this. They don't have the money that you have at that point. They don't have those things. They're not in that place. What we ask of a lot of these athletes, man, to stand in this under these circumstances that they're in is not something that people do regularly at their own jobs. People, a whole lot of people out here swallow stuff at their job every day telling these cats they need to kneel during the national anthem. Whole lot of those same people, if they go to a sporting event, are going to stand during the national anthem because they don't want people to throw stuff at them. And they're going to tell these dudes what they're supposed to do. No. Those cats aren't in a position where they could really make that sacrifice that it is that we're talking about doing. They can't. That being said, at some point, I'm willing to bet that Dak Prescott is going to look back at some of the things that he said there. And he's probably going to wish that he had not put them like that. I do believe that. I do believe that there's going to be a time as he gets older and as he sees more of the world and he deals with more people who are going to treat him different ways and not care about who he is because they don't recognize him or whatever it is. I do think that he is probably going to come away looking at what he said and wishing he hadn't done it. Because here's the problem that you have when you say something like Prescott said there before the media. What happens is your words get used and manipulated by people who aren't operating from the same sentiment that you are. Your words are going to wind up being weaponized by people who do not exactly wish you well. Like you wind up becoming the face of something that you never intended to be the face of. And this is where it gets to be tricky to be a cat like him, because on one hand, I look at it, I'm like, look, he gets to have his opinion. He gets to feel however it is that he feels. But those cats don't really get to do that, right? Like there's a luxury. He should be able to just say however he feels and then that just be what it is. But 1968, Jesse Owens went to the Olympics, and you can look up the things that he said when he was at the Olympics. He was allowed to feel the way he felt. But he was used as a person in opposition to cats like Tommy Smith and John Carlos. Those words weren't really his anymore. They weren't. And then Jesse saw some more. And then by the time before he died, Jesse Owens wrote a book that was entitled, I Have Changed. This happens very often for young cats in situations. Jesse Owens went young in 1968. But this happens very often for young cats in a lot of these situations, man. And so he gets to feel how he feels. And the Cowboys have their policy. Let Jerry Jones sell his own policy. You don't have to be the one to do it for him. And there's a chance you may regret the fact that you took that on for yourself. All right. LeBron James is opening up a school. Now, what I find interesting about LeBron opening up this school is the opening school game is a little tricky. And here's why the opening school game is tricky. Man, I don't know nothing about opening no damn school. Like, I think Deion Sanders, he's got a school in Dallas. He's got a charter school down there. And there's been all kinds of questions about how it is that that place has been run. Like, I mean, that's one of those things that's a lot harder than it looks like it is on TV. A lot harder than it looks like it is on TV. But LeBron's school is interesting. This is actually a public school. It is a public school, and it was built in conjunction with LeBron and his foundation. But what I found to be interesting about this school is this school is taking kids who are testing below grade level. Like, this is a school that is trying basically to save kids from the schools that they were in before. And look, kids below grade level, I blame the school. Like, reading below grade level, I don't blame the kid. I don't really blame their parents. I blame the school. It's the school's job to educate the kids, whether their parents want them to be educated or not. Right? We can't be leaving education out in the hands of the decisions made by parents. You know what? We can't be leaving that in the hands of parents because y'all are parents. I know y'all. I don't trust y'all with much at all. You know? So anyway, this dude is just so impressive. And I understand why there are lots of people who look at the way that this network covers LeBron James and think that there's a measure of overkill to it. And you're probably right. The only point of disagreement that I would have with you is, one, LeBron remains fascinating. And two, when we don't talk about LeBron, y'all change the channel. Just so you know, right? You know, we don't talk about him. Y'all go on to move on to something else. But he is so impressive. He's so impressive. I mean, this is the child star who made good. And he always seemed to get it in a unique sort of way when he was young. And he certainly had his missteps along the way as he went. But now we're getting to observe LeBron still like in his prime, like the back end of his prime, but still in his prime. But we've also grown with him like to the point of adulthood. And we are witnessing him being an adult, like not just, oh, he's old, you know, he used to be little and now he's a grown up now. We witness LeBron in ways, for example, like we don't witness Kobe. Like now I think we see a little bit more of it because we see Kobe like coaching his daughter's AAU team and all of that stuff. But Kobe is the 7-year difference between those two guys entered the league is a major difference in terms of technology and like what role LeBron plays on social and stuff like that now. But, like, we see LeBron be somebody's father. We see him just in a way that I feel like, you know, people give you all kinds of presentations of who they are. And, you know, we can very often be conned. We've gotten conned by a lot of people. And it's a dangerous game to assume that you know strangers. But, like, when you hear LeBron talking about his kids and stuff like that, like, I just find myself to be like, yo, man, you really seem to like have figured some of this stuff out. Like, I love hearing him talk about this on his uninterrupted show, talking about how he regrets naming his son after himself. Like, check this out.
I still regret giving my 14-year-old my name because of that.
Right.
Like, when I was younger, obviously, I didn't have a dad. So my whole thing was like, whenever I have a kid, not only is he going to be a junior, I'm going to do everything that this man didn't do.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're going to experience things that I didn't experience. The only thing I could do is give them the blueprint, and it's up to them to take their own course.
Like, that to me was such a prescient observation that he had. And I never know, like, I wonder a lot of times, especially with famous people, if they regret making those decisions to put their names on their children in those ways because it makes it difficult for them to grow into their own personalities. But, like, hearing him talk about it and with the confidence that he talked about it, he was like, yo, man, yeah, you know, I didn't have my dad around, so I wanted to make sure that my son knew that I was proud of him, you know, those sorts of things about putting his name on it. Though I would like to note there's a whole lot of daddies that did not grow up with seniors. That trick doesn't work that well. But all those different things and just like how he looked at the world and how he looks at like what he wants these things to be for his kids and stuff like that. It is amazing to me that this dude turned out to be so normal. Like all the things were set up there for him to be some sort of basket case or some sort of socially maladjusted person. And that's not really what happened. Like, I mean, he didn't exactly, aside from that whole like genetic, you know, physical freak thing. It's not like LeBron drew the best hand out there outside of that, right? Like, there's a whole lot of different reasons that this could have gone wrong from him. And it's interesting. Reasons that could have gone wrong from him, ranging from the poverty he started with to the riches he ultimately amassed. He seemed to get through both of them pretty well, right? He seemed to get through both of them pretty well. And that is, like, really, 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 really wild to consider. He has figured out how to be, and this is like not necessarily something I praise him for, but just something I find to be interesting. He has figured out how to be out front on a lot of social things and charity things and stuff like that, but never really gives an impression of being radical in that way. Cause I don't think it's possible to be LeBron James and truly be someone that is like espousing radical views before the world. It's just hard to balance being both. At this point, I understand it. I'm not really so mad at him. Like, it's normally not that guy that goes into that place. And I totally understand why it is that, you know, I would guess in a lot of ways that he navigates it in the way that he does. But nobody's going to argue that LeBron ain't paying attention. Nobody's going to argue that LeBron doesn't care. And even if you wanted to argue it, you'd have a really hard time doing so when the cat's out here opening schools. Like, legitimately opening schools. And just something for people to think about, like when these cats do things like open schools. And again, I often have questions about, you know, the quality of the school, how it's going to be run and stuff like that. But I feel like we should look at somebody like LeBron and the work that he's doing to open a school. We should look at that the same way that we look at it, like the charitable endeavors that Dikembe Mutombo has in the Congo. you know, Mutombo built a hospital, you know, and all kinds of other things that he's done down there to help people out with his money. And when you see those stories about Mutombo when he goes there, of course, part of it is built around what a magnanimous person he is for being willing to do this. But the other part is built around, like, the poverty of where he is and, you know, like how dire the circumstances are for the people who work in those places, I mean, who live in those places, and how great it is to have someone like Dikembe Mutombo who is willing to go back and do that. That is very similar to what we have when we have so many people like Jalen Rose, an example. He's opened his school in Detroit. LeBron's got this one in Akron. But for all these guys that are going and putting their money into opening schools, there are two things that we should do that are similar to the Mutombo case. One, we should think about the fact that people are willing to do this with their own money and how kind it is of them to do that. And number two, if it makes you sad to think about the fact that Dikembe Mutombo has to be the one to put the money down to build the hospital, it should also make you sad that LeBron James has to be the one to figure out how to do this in Akron. It shouldn't be that poor in the Congo. It shouldn't be that hard in Akron either. All right, so check this out. This weekend, I went to the Overwatch Finals. That's right. I went to the Overwatch Finals. Overwatch, for those of you who are like closer to my age and don't have children and stuff like that, or just don't really have time to play video games, Overwatch is what they call a first-person shooter, I think. Gabe, do you play Overwatch?
I don't. I was really excited to hear your explanation of what it was. So,
well, like, do you play video games at all?
I play FIFA, and that's
okay.
It.
Gotcha. Like, I don't play them anymore. This is my interpretation of Overwatch, and I could have it wrong, and I'm sure that if I have it wrong, people will blow me up. But by the time I finished watching the Overwatch Finals, I was able to explain to the old people who were sitting next to me how the game worked, and I felt like my explanation was appropriate. So, okay, here's how this thing went with the Overwatch. So, you have two teams. There were teams of five. It was one team from London, and it was another team from Philadelphia. And they alternate between which team has the truck. I think they call it the payload, but it is basically a truck. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to take the truck from wherever it starts to some finish line. But, you know, people are trying to kill you while you do it, and you got a limited time for when you, you know, for getting the truck over there. But one way that you can get more time is that if you kill people. So you kill people, you get more time, and then you push the truck over. And then they were doing it. It was almost like tennis, right? Like best of five sets, something like that. You with me? Did that make sense?
I am with you. Was this your first time watching someone else play video games in this manner?
Yeah, absolutely. Come on now. I went because somehow I think ESPN televised it, so we had some tickets. And so I went on Saturday with some buddies, Pablo Rowe with me, Eric Rowe with me, my man Y Snack. We all went out and we watched it. And so this is the Barclays Center, right? I walked into Barclays Center and that bad boy was jumping. It was jumping. I mean, they got DJ Envy on the ones and twos, and he was playing like hard stuff. Like, he had him in there knocking. It was edited mixes, but whatever, you know. He had him in there knocking. Gabe, filled to the rafters. The floor was full of seats, and it was full. And when it would get to some kind of flourish or whatever in the video game where the truck was getting closer, or they about to kill all the people on the truck before they can get the truck going, I mean, the people were on their feet. Try this. Me and Pablo sitting on the row, and all of a sudden from behind us, we hear somebody say, "It's high noon." And we turned around, and it was Rick Fox.
Wow.
Rick Fox owns a gaming team. I've come to find through some of my cursory research of the esports that this happens a lot with rich people, where their kids get really into it, and then they start, you know, since they got the money, they put a little money behind it. But no, man, Rick Fox, I think his team is called Echo Fox. They had their gear. Like, they was all set up there. He was so excited to be there for it, man. He was so excited. After it was over, I talked to this dude, and he's an agent. And he told me that he represented one of the guys on the team, and that he was like, "Yo, man, I'm just really happy for him," because he had a wrist injury during the season. And, you know, that's a terrible thing for a gamer. And, you know, he said he had his wrist injury. and that the dude was, you know, really down about having the wrist injury, so he was so happy for him about the idea that he could get himself pumped back up to wind up at the promised land. And I was like, damn, that's how we talking about video games now, huh?
Yeah, it's a little worse than carpal tunnel, right?
Yeah, no, man, I met another dude. He was an athletic director at a historically black college, and he told me that he was trying to get, like, a gaming program started at the school. And on one level, I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's really cool. On the other level, I'm like, how about you put that controller down and get your nose in those books? I turned into that person immediately. Like, I feel like that's a poor use of your time, young man. It's so much that's going on there. Like, I don't know if they're going to be able to, like, really make this a thing as a spectator sport, because I didn't find it to be, like, it was interesting to be in the room, but I don't think this is something that I would want to watch on television. But apparently the kids watch each other play video games all the time on the internet.
Because this is, like, upgrading big time on just watching, you know, your friends play video games while you wait for your turn, right?
Yes.
This is, like, whole next level to it. I'm interested in watching people at the professional level do this. I think that the website you're referring to is called, like, Twitch.
Yes,
that is correct.
Where
people can watch other people play video games. I mean, I see people, like, in the fantasy community, like Al Zeidenfeld, he's, like, super active on there, and a bunch of people follow him.
I got friends who used to, like, plug up the Nintendo 64 and watch the WWF wrestling game play itself. But they were high. You know, like they didn't think anything was on television, so they would just put wrestling on themselves. This is before we had DVR and all this on demand stuff, Gabe. We have a different age range. I feel like we were doing this stuff while you may have been in elementary school. What were you doing in the year 1998?
I was 7. So
yeah, that would
yeah. I wasn't doing much at that time. I'm not even sure if I was, you know, in my consciousness at that point.
Well, I'm just saying my friends were all ahead of this gaming thing. They were just high. Like that was the only difference of it. But it really made me rethink a lot of stuff though, because I mean, the stuff is important because people think it's important, and that's the only explanation. Like, it doesn't matter whether I think it's important. There's thousands and millions of people who think that this is important, and so this is really, 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 like, I don't even want to say becoming a thing, and a lot of, I mean, it is its own thing. I don't know what it's going to turn into on the screen. Like, I don't think it reflects well upon us as a people to be sitting around watching folks play video games on television. I just do not. I could totally understand you going to the venue to watch it, man, because it was a real communal sort of activity. There was like an energy there. Gabe, I ain't gonna lie, I feel like, couldn't you just be playing video games yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna ask, now that we've, like, you know, examined the importance of it, maybe we need to rewind a little bit and just kind of survey the scene a little bit, right? So, packed house, bumping music. Is everybody watching on the Jumbotron? Is there a big screen?
Well, you can watch. Well, there's the Jumbotron, but also the players are on the stage. So five on each side. And there's graphics on the stage that you can watch there. And on the Jumbotron, you get individual shots of all the players.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a big production, and they were treating it like sports, man. Like, all the elements of a sports television production were present on this. The announcers, the whole nine. And, you know, you would think it's video games, you know, y'all ain't got to dress up. Those announcers were dressed up like it was Monday Night Football.
what about the food spread? Was the food good? Good drinks? Yeah. Was it open bar?
We had a VIP situation, you know what I'm saying? So, like, we was up at the 40-40, and the food looked like it was all right. There was a red carpet. There were people in costumes, and people who do the voices of characters show up, and they do like their catchphrase or whatever, and the crowd goes crazy. I think my ultimate conclusion that I reached in coming out of that is I feel like I'm a little less judgmental of the whole idea than I was going into it. I do admit that, so we all define ourselves in all kinds of ways, right? Like, we all have different activities that, you know, perhaps we participate in, and then it becomes I'm a whatever the thing happens to be, right? It's still wild to me that people define themselves as a gamer, right? Like, when it went from I play video games to I am a gamer. Does that make sense? Like, the difference between the two?
Oh, completely.
Yeah, like, even the user base, you played a whole lot of video games, that was something, but it's interesting that this is the place in which a lot of people then define themselves. But the thing is, so many people do, and as a result, there are going to be things like these events that create, like, this kind of communal sort of situation. Like, Mina Kimes, wrote a story. And for those of you who only know Mina off of television stuff, Mina is one of the coldest writers walking. Like, she does absolutely incredible work. And she had done a story on a Korean girl. I think she was Korean, but she was a dominant gamer. And she was so dominant that those boys online refused to believe that she was actually a girl. They couldn't. They thought it had to be like some sort of con. I mean, it writes in the story about the girls setting up in this line of girls down the block to meet her because she was like so important to them, because the idea that a girl could be good at video games is actually empowering. Like, the things that matter change from generation to generation. And so as much as I might look at that and be like, wow, that's strange, it don't matter. No, strange ain't even the right word, but you know what I mean. It doesn't matter how I feel about it, man. This is who they are. This is where they are. And these are the spaces that they're going to hang out. And who knows, maybe by making this stuff bigger and making it more public, that will then require them to do a little bit to improve the way that people in these circles behave, particularly on matters of race, gender, and sexuality. Does that seem fair? Because I think that's the one thing about this. Okay, we talk about them going back, getting them old tweets and them baseball players. What do you think they're going to, what do you think I have in the video game people?
Oh, man. I mean, there's so many jokes, like unfair jokes when it comes to gamers about, oh, you know, the dude's living at mom's house, living in mom's basement, that sort of thing. Can you imagine what those guys are tweeting?
Yeah.
Those like guys are the trolls, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, they troll each other throughout the games.
Yeah.
Right? Like, people talk about the things they hear and they are told, like, as grown men. They're like, yo, I can't be playing video games online with the headset. Some 12-year-old ain't about to be talking to me like this. Like if this is going to really get to where we treat it like pro sports, they're going to be like, oh, no, we got to shut this down. That being said, anytime something like that happens, the rules are always modified from sport to sport. Like, I don't know if you remember this, okay, but back in the day, they didn't do all that X Games stuff. At the Winter Olympics, they started adding it, and then somebody, I forget who it was, they won a gold medal in one of them Winter X Game type sports, but it was, you know, an Olympic gold medal, but the person failed the drug test, and they tried to take their medals from them, and they were like, hold on, we ain't never agreed to that.
I don't remember.
Yeah, they're like, look, man, if we couldn't get high, we'd have never come to the Olympics. What are you, crazy? I got something back into Rome. And they had to give him back his medals because they had never agreed to that. So who knows? Maybe they'll give the video gamers a different set of rules. Otherwise, delete your Twitter account right now. All right, guys, I used to wear suits off the rack. Then I got my first made-to-measure suit, and you can't go back after that. And so you've got to try it. And Indochino is the world's most exciting made-to-measure menswear company. They make suits and shirts to your exact measurements for an unparalleled fit and comfort. Look, man, guys love the wide selection of high-quality fabrics and colors to choose from. You also get the option to personalize the details. Your lapel, your lining, your pockets, the buttons, writing on your own monogram. Now, here's the way that it works. You visit a stylist at a showroom, and you have them take your measurements personally. Or measure yourself at home and shop online at Indochino.com. Choose the fabric inside and out. Choose your design customization. You submit your measurements with your choices and relax while your suit gets professionally tailored and mailed to you in a couple of weeks. This week, my listeners can get any premium Indochino suit for just $359 at Indochino.com when entering Bomani at checkout. That's 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit, and shipping is free. Indochino.com, promo code Bomani for any premium suit for just $359 and free shipping. It's an incredible deal for a premium made-to-measure suit. Ah, yes, the right time book club. We were reading a book, by the way, that has, like, none of that pretense to it. Reading Friday Night Lights by Buzz Bissinger, the story of the Odessa Permian Panthers. And joining me to talk about this book is a man who has spent a great deal of time in West Texas. You can find him as the co-host of High Noon. His name is Pablo Torre. And just in case you were curious, he's never dunked a basketball before.
Not yet.
Not on a 10-foot goal.
Not yet. I'm going to get those shoes that they put in the back of those magazines we had mm-hmm. when we were younger.
You're going to get yourself right.
I'm going to get those moon shoes, and I'm going to come in, and I'm going to show you a videotape of me throwing one down, and then I will laugh. But until then, you are correct.
Yep, just making sure that you have an understanding of this. Now, you had not read Friday Night Lights before this undertaking.
No, I have never dunked, and I had never read this book. It is a cultural blind spot for me. The most I've gotten from Friday Night Lights is listening to Explosions in the Sky, which I understand was the theme song for the TV show. But the book has been foreign territory till now.
But I find interesting, yes, the book is the cultural blind spot, but in reading this, because you're a New Yorker, and that is part of what I think is interesting about this, because to me, the themes of the book are very, very familiar. But
yes.
You are of a slightly different world.
Yes. No, there is a bunch here that struck me as, oh yeah, okay, no, this is the place that we refer to when we talk about the caricature in some ways of West Texas, yeah.
Yeah, but not even West, let's be fair. The caricature of West Texas doesn't have people in it. That is West is, oh boy, they're different. They're over there. Like that's a part of Texas that I'd have no like reason or thing to go to, but the thing I relate to, I mean, just the notion of the cultural significance of high school football. Like, it's a thing.
I did not have a football team in my high school. So this is all make believe in a way that I've come to, really be fascinated by.
Yeah, but there's a social hierarchy at your school based on activities though, right?
Oh yeah, it was the debate team and I was, you're right, the captain of the GD debate team.
But that was the squad.
That was the squad.
Like, and I'm curious at the dynamic of how that goes though, because it was also all boys,
all
right?
All boys, and so much of this, obviously, in Friday Night Lights at Permian is through the lens of, yeah, these kids are adults. They are treated like adults, but at the same time are deeply and severely and problematically infantilized at other times. Yeah. So that's another dynamic to it.
Yeah, but I think part of why I think that this is a book that people need to read is I think it is one of the greatest looks at race in the late 20th century of the United States that is disguised as a book about football. Football seems to kind of be really secondary. All of this centers and stems around race, all the way down to the way they draw the lines to decide who gets to play at the school.
Crazy.
And who gets zoned in. Like, what was your thought in reading that when you saw that the desegregation of these schools really had a lot to do with how could we make our football teams better?
It made so much sense, obviously, once you spell it out, that the entire reason anyone is urged to desegregate is for the personal profit. And personal profit is measured most primarily in this part of the world in football. But just the dateline, Bo, right? 1982.
Yes.
I mean, it's just a good reminder that we're not far away from when this was segregated.
Yes.
It's wild.
Well, but except the problem is now they figured out how to do it without it being done exactly that way. But you're right. 1982. Look, there's this little town in Texas closer to my way called Vider. Vider's in East Texas between Port Arthur and the state line. I don't know exactly where it is. Yo, man, they had a fight to desegregate the projects in Vider in the 90s. In the 90s. Like, this idea of, you know, 1965 is not quite the date that people think it is when it comes to the notion of integration. Because after that, it was all kinds of fights that we had to have, you know, in order to get this. But part of what I think was interesting, and the people said this, that there was the black high school there, and their fear was with integration, when integration came, their high school would go away. And that's exactly what happened.
Yep. Ector.
Yes.
Ector. And yeah, 90% minorities and yeah, Mexicans and blacks. And that's the other ingredient in all of this that the book, this part of the book explores is, yeah, black people, real useful to football. Mexicans, less useful.
Yes. Therefore, useful for working at things.
Yeah, they did not. I mean, so insofar as there was this pecking order, football clearly was this thing that could selectively and temporarily elevate someone like Booby Miles.
Yes.
And of course, once they decide that you're no longer useful, we enter something that we are quite familiar with, which is the disposability of the athlete, which we still obviously deal with very much at the highest levels of pro football today.
Now, were you jarred by the widespread use of the N-word in Odessa?
I was. I remember on our show on High Noon, you had mentioned, I forget what the context was, but where you were, this place in Atlanta, some restaurant that, you know, the N-word was still being said, and I was like, oh, that's probably figurative. And then you go and you read this and just how completely, completely matter-of-fact it was. Again, it's one of those things. 1982, not that far back, the N-word being this commonly accepted.
And that's like 88. Like, when we start talking about this in the current time of that book, you know, like, that's like 88. It was still... The thing, though, that I think is interesting about that and where I think is useful in this book. Now, Bissinger himself was a bit thrown off. I think he was living in Philadelphia at the time, and he was a bit thrown off. And I do believe that there are some segments of perhaps more genteel society where this doesn't happen so much. But people act so mortified at the idea that a white person said the N-word like it's rare.
Well, and the book establishes that the meaning, the particular meaning of the N-word as juxtaposed against black,
yes,
as a descriptor, that whether you were an N-word or whether you were black was A, decided by the white person who happened to be around at the time, but B, that it spoke to a behavior, a sense of self that was lower or higher, depended on how you comported yourself in whatever way made all of these other people uncomfortable.
Yeah, and it's really hard to win at that one. And you know what that would make me think of? Because I went to school in a little town with like 1,500 people. And I've always said that I personally felt overwhelmingly like I was treated well in that town and by most people. Like I don't have negative impressions of it. Kind of got a bunch of sometimes that's because they had decided that I was the mythical black person as opposed to the rest of these. See, that's another level of this that I don't think this book really gets to a good place of touching on. It's like, for what it's like if you exist in this experience and you recognize, oh, it's not that you think we cool, you just rock with me.
Yes, yeah, specifically you.
Right.
High achieving, well spoken
yes.
You.
Only you,
yes.
By the way.
To the exclusion of the rest.
The exclusion of everybody else. Now, kind of on this topic, at JCH04 said a big thing that got him was he felt as though the folks in Odessa were basically minimizing those other people and their struggles and like blaming them for their own oppressions and they're complicit in the situation they're in. And one thing I do find that this touches on that gets lost is the dangers and what happens with high levels of segregation. And so the argument that they make for people on the business end of segregation is, well, you had your chance to do your stuff and look at what it was, as though everybody's playing like we get the pot 50-50 and then split it from there.
Right. And when we get to, skipping ahead briefly, but when you get to the Odessa versus Permian dynamic, where the one school is now full of Mexicans in
yes.
Chapter 8, yeah, the reputation of that school is down in the dumps because everyone is assuming that, yeah, the Mexicans basically came in and ruined this for us.
Yeah, and also because we're in Chapter 5, we talk about this, did you also pick up on the way that any black person that got any level of political power somehow magically turned out to be responsible for a crime?
It was startling. And I thought Bissinger actually presented this as fairly as he could while also being matter of fact about it, insofar as he sort of told us up front, like, here are the characters. But at the same time, it reminded me of something that I think about today with, like, Kaepernick stuff, right? Which is, the message is so much less fun to discuss at the moment in time than the messenger. Like, these people, their messages were clearly on the right side of history. But the idea that you could pick at someone and say, well, you did this, and therefore not only is your status as messenger invalidated, but the message therefore is invalidated, speaks to, yeah, how little interest people had in the message to begin with.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other part of it is, and this is like the dilemma, is if people start with an initial negative presumption of you based on race, then anything that you ever do wrong then becomes confirmation bias, and then it goes from there. Like,
yes.
There's always a countdown to some time equals capital T, at which point you are going to ruin this.
Yeah, but the stories are crazy. Yeah, Lenita Atkins, one of the Democrats in the city. And then you get to Lawrence Hurd, who's like in jail when Bissinger interviews him. It speaks to how long it took for people to realize that there was some real systemic stuff that needed to change. When you could just point to the messenger, it's easy to keep brushing it aside.
Yeah, and also I thought it was funny, the dude that got locked up for arson conspiracy, he says it was a political setup, and I feel like their response to that was, yep, got you. How about that?
That was the end of that.
Yeah, we set you up and you got that. Now, we went to Chapter 6, The Ambivalence of Ivory, and that was the interesting one with this running back, Ivory Christian, who, you know, liked football, but he didn't find the game to be that Christian. Like, what'd you think of that?
Look, I did go to a Catholic school. I understand the religiosity element of all of this. But it did make me wonder how hard it must be because we learn about all the other stuff his peers are up to. Like, he is refusing the privilege afforded to him as a black player, right? Like, you get...
And by privilege, we're basically talking about white women.
Correct. No, you get to taste from the thing that the rest of you cannot taste. And he's like, nah, not for me. Which is fascinating. And I wonder how much of that figured into his faith. But the other thing, of course, is the fact that we do meet Odell Beckham Sr.
Yes.
And believe you me, I immediately Wikipedia'd Odell Beckham just to make sure that this was the same one.
Because there could be, I applaud your attention to detail to hear about this particular Odell Beckham and ask, I wonder if his son is Odell Beckham of the Giants.
Well, I assume there are other Odells and I assume there are other Beckhams. I just wasn't sure how many Odell Beckhams there were.
Yeah, and Bruton Andy makes the point. It seems Odell ain't fall too far from the tree.
Oh, no, he was like a star.
Yeah.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Everything they're saying about young Odell, they seem to say about old Odell, except old Odell was in Marshall, Texas.
Oh, and I do recommend, by the way, Googling Odell Beckham Sr. just to see what he's up to. Like, he pops up on Instagram. He's a character. He's commenting on stuff.
You went rabbit hole on this, didn't you?
I did. And you know what? The new dude that Odell Beckham Jr. is... Yeah, behind every new dude is an old dude.
Who was a new dude of his day.
Who was a new dude at the time.
Right, so it tells me I need to go back and look that up. Like, Odell Beckham Sr. probably out here dressed like one of the dudes in the time going to the club. Out here looking like Shalimar. But no, that's what it is. Also, what did you think about the idea that these kids were on a private jet?
That, the book is so much grounded in the hardscrabble, the dust, the desert. And then you're like, oh, okay, no, they have a private jet as well. I mean, it does tell you what are the priorities.
But you know what, though? This is also part of why I understand why people in that town really cashed in on the glory of being on that team. Because, hey, look, man, let's be real about this. I make a lot of money, right? You make a lot of money.
Hmm?
You been on a private jet?
Not my own. But as a journalist, I was on a private jet with Canelo Alvarez on a boxing thing.
But as a journalist, I mean, just
oh no,
like,
yeah, I'm not contributing to the payment of jets.
Right, not even contributing to the payment of jet, or just being around the people that's going to get you on a private jet. Like, you're not there. These dudes have been on private jets. There's somebody right now working at an HVAC shop in Odessa, and he's telling me about the private jet. So yeah, I see how it is. They might cash in because one thing about this book in this town. They're intimately acquainted with the idea that your life will never get better than this.
Right.
They're not even like this, and I think it's another thing that's lost in this story. They're not even trying to send people to the league here.
Well, that's the thing. At one point, Bissinger runs over the numbers, and you realize that there is a more real and important reward that comes with being a big-time football player in this town. The reward is now.
Yes.
It's now. This is it. Enjoy it. Because afterwards, yeah, you're not going to go to the league. You're not going to play in college unless you're, yeah, an Odell Beckham Sr. type player. And yeah, you'll probably get hurt and be disposed of as soon as that happens.
Yeah, they're operating like the math problem they're looking at is different because we often chastise people for making too heavy an investment in the athletics for their kids because the likelihood of making the pros is so small. And they're looking at it as the likelihood of you going to the pros is so small. Therefore, you absolutely should invest right now.
I mean, they have in this school a class of female students whose job it is, literal job, is to like bake cookies, bring them handwritten signs of support, like a personalized cheerleader.
Yes.
I mean, that is futile. That is beyond a reward. It's like being, having a royal servant.
Yeah. And look, we're in chapter 7 now when we talk about this. And I mean, the ways that the girls at school are viewed relative to the football players is insane.
Yeah, it's total. I mean, insofar as objectification can be made colorful and clear, this chapter is where that is established.
I mean, just every single, like, all of it, even like with the teachers, right? The question about whether the teachers are prioritizing their actual, you know, what's being priority. The teachers think that the kids don't care because they care too much about football. But I'm like, damn, but so many of them on the football team.
I did wonder about. There's a passage where a teacher wonders whether the kids these days, something has changed, whether it's something different, because back when, however, a decade before, she was saying that it didn't seem to be this hard to reach the students in the 80s. And that did seem like maybe a cyclical kind of concern, because I do feel like teachers today are saying that ever more given the internet and such.
And they low-key blame black people.
Well, yeah, there's also that.
Right. Like the SAT, also the SAT scores go down. Well, you know, they low-key kill black people. That would have been bad. Sorry. I didn't mean to say that.
Another quick note. Yeah, the football program had two computers. The English department had one.
Yes. Yes.
Like, yeah, okay. Yep. The writing is on the wall when it comes to, why a school exists when your computers are more heavily invested in the athletics department.
Yeah, and at Ms. Chris Holmes made that exact point about that, said it conditioned low expectations. I would just also like to point out, by the way, because this is one of my pet causes, you know, people very frequently like to make this argument that black people hate education and all of this stuff. Mm-hmm. But this young lady, Julie Gardner, who is being chastised for being smart while at her school, I don't think it was the brown people that were getting on her about that one.
Statistically speaking, that would not be the case.
Yeah, I don't believe that is where they are. Now, this is a quote from a board member said, if we prepared our kids academically as we prepare them for winning state championships, there is no telling where we would be right now. And she's kind of right.
Well, if you truly care about something,
yes.
Like the thing, right. So one of the things I was thinking about while reading this book was, what's actually special about this place? Like, how much of this is Buzz Bissinger picking a subject that is vivid and useful, and how much of it is him finding the place that cares the most about something? And I don't know if there are other places that can clearly argue that they care more. But once you establish that this is how you define your entire identity, not just as a school, but as a school district, as a city, as a state, yeah, no, I believe you. If you cared as much about anything like you do about this, great things, I imagine, would follow. Yeah.
The only thing, though, is, of course, there are all kinds of other issues that didn't come up. Like, everybody's just like, we just poured all our money into schools, everything would be okay. And it's like, okay, well, like, kinda, sorta, that's not exactly how these things manage to go. But, again, these are things that they say are black people problems, right?
Yes.
Like, this is the devalue of education right here. This is prioritizing athletics over education. This is something that anybody in this society is capable of, is my point. That people have all kinds of things that they take a certain measure of pride in, and they'll do it through schools at the expense of actual education. But I would say there's no difference between what they're doing here. Now, granted, it's high school, so we feel like the stakes are higher, but that's no different than what they're doing to people with college athletics.
Yep.
This is what you're here for.
The other thing that was interesting about that dynamic was, the school's reputation before desegregation was as like a team of Wes Welkers, basically.
Yes.
It was the White Grinders.
Yes.
And what a testament to the character of the White Grinder that they were that good.
Yes.
But then collectively everyone admitted, vis-a-vis desegregation, yeah, we're going to want to get some athletes. We loved ourselves and that image of self, but we also want to, beat Odell Beckham Jr.
But generally, we don't want any more than we have to have because we like being the Grinders.
Yes. So they want to have both. They want to be both.
We want to be the Grinders, but we don't want to be losers. That in the end, but that's how college football integration took place before it got to be where it is now, where the competitive stakes are too high. Mm-hmm. Basically, the issue is not that you need black people. It is that you cannot afford to turn away anybody that might be good. Right? Like, the stakes are too high for you to turn away qualified applicants in the name of aesthetics and your ego.
Right. The idea of, oh, you're a Florida person or you're an Auburn person. How many stars do you have?
Yeah. Just go whatever it takes, right? No matter what it is, you just can't be out here. Like, the reason why some schools have knuckleheads year after year, because those are the schools that can't afford to whittle down the population. They got to take good however good comes. And sometimes good comes to them because good can't go nowhere else.
Right.
Right. But that's how it goes. And it's the same thing here. It's not even necessarily black people are just so fast. No, you can't be turning down fast people because they're black. That's it.
Yep. No, it's stumbling backwards into the veneer of equality.
Yes. Now we get to chapter 8, where it's the Odessa and Permian rivalry. And remember, there were three high schools before, right? Odessa, Permian, and Ector. And Ector was the minority school, and that one wound up shutting down. And so Odessa basically became the minority school with just enough pockets carved out for Permian to get themselves some football players.
Yes.
And then they played against each other. And I thought it was interesting the way that Bissinger talked about Permian and beating Odessa as how it had to feel as like the white school. And you are beating your lesser, browner counterpart.
Right, right. And the only solution proposed ended up being, well, what if we just combine schools and consolidate? And that would evade the entire dilemma, which, of course, was highly problematic for the winners. Like, why do we need to become more Hispanic? Right. That's your issue.
Right. They're like, no, we're over here good at football, doing our thing. Like, what? That I had not thought about it quite in that way. But, like, what do we get out of this?
Yeah. No. No. We like being, we like being on top. Don't, to quote Kevin Durant, don't worry what goes on at the top of things.
Yeah, you're right. They're like, look, we can't beat you guys in football, so how about we become a part of your school? Sorry, senor. That's not what we want. Like, that's absolutely how they are viewing this.
Yes. The idea that race is, I mean, it's just, it's, it, you read this, these chapters specifically, and if you thought that you could talk about football in Texas without talking about race, I have no idea how you would try to do that.
Oh, no, there's no chance. There's zero chance at all that you could do this. And also, while I'm thinking about it, Gabe made this point, and I thought that it was a very good one. They're shutting a school down because the athletics aren't good. They're not shutting the athletics down. They want to shut down the whole damn school.
Right, right. Your utility is how good you can make people feel as a football team.
But all politics are local, man. And see, and that's the thing about Texas, I think, in particular, that gets lost when talking about high school football is how spread out Texas is. Texas has 254 counties. 254, right. But a lot of these places are also not close to anything. Like you and I were talking a little earlier today about the idea of like your local football team or whatever. The local football team here is the high school.
Right.
Like that's right. How that works. And like that's their franchise. That's their college. That's what all of that is. That's what the local football team is. And so everything about their self-image, like I learned a lot about the sports that we cover really came from this book and the understanding of the role that identity plays in these local sports and how it's not just about the games, it's about what the games are ultimately saying about you yourself, like what it projects to the rest of the world about what kind of person you are. And I'd never really thought of it in that way, that it was that important on that very, very local, personal, and human level.
Well, it seems that Odessa has a couple of things going for it. One of them is football. The other is oil, and the oil comes and goes.
Yes.
And if the oil comes and goes, how consistently can you feel good about yourself?
Well, that's the other part, too. The co-star of this story is oil. It's the ups and downs of the oil prices. And so much that happened in Odessa, because their times, they were living fat.
Right. And by the way, like, it answers the question of why is anyone living here?
Oil.
Oil. Because there's money in the ground that randomly and unpredictably pops up. Makes sense.
Right. And when it goes, everything is great. And when it's not, man, they want that football team to be good.
When it's not, you better be making me feel good about myself.
You better win. You imagine that pressure as a child, like as a teenager.
It's too much. It's unhealthy. And that's, I don't know how all of these stories end. We've introduced to so many of these characters now, these players, but everything feels like it's tinged with sadness. Like none of this feels sustainable.
No. No, there's not a happy person in this book that I can think of.
Yeah, I haven't met him yet.
There's not a... Wait till you get to the end. Some of the stuff at the end is just going to hit you like, oh, damn.
Like, I know a kid goes to Harvard and stuff. I hope that, like, goes well. But that was also in the context of his girlfriend telling him, I can date you because Hispanics are almost white.
Yeah, it kind of depends.
Certainly is a case-by-case scenario. But for Brian Chavez, he seemed to be on the right side of the pigmentation Mason Dixon.
There he is. That is my man Pablo Torre with our second installment of the Right Time Book Club. That was chapters 5 through 8. But ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us here on the Right Time. We do this thing here a couple times a week. Gabe Bassain handles everything behind the scenes. Thank you, sir. Thanks to Indochino, our sponsor. Thanks to Pablo Torre for joining us here. Also, guys, for the month of August, we are going to be doing one podcast a week. One podcast a week for the month of August. But it's going to be a really good podcast. Don't be mad about it. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.
The Right Time with Bomani Jones is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear. more driven.